This year is the Knox 500. We do not know the day when John Knox was born. He certainly wasn't one for birthdays, so we don't know the date. But we do know the year. He was born in 1514. So this year we should be focusing on John Knox and the Reformation in Scotland. As the books of Martin Luther and Tyndale's translation of the New Testament entered Scotland, there was great interest. And the students at St. Andrew's University began to take their faith seriously. Patrick Hamilton, a student of St. Andrew's, wrote a book that was condemned as heretical. He fled to Germany, he met with Martin Luther, and soon he returned to Scotland and began preaching a Protestant faith with great boldness. By an act of Parliament on the 17th of July 1525, the importation of Luther's books into Scotland was prohibited. In 1528, the Archbishop of St. Andrews summoned Hamilton for a debate, so-called, but he had no intention of debating him. It was a trap. And before any of Hamilton's friends could come to his defense, a church court found him guilty, and this was in such haste, and while most heresy trials took weeks, Hamilton's was rushed through in less than 12 hours. And considering how long it took for news to travel and people to travel, there was no real time for the defense to muster. But it took six long, excruciatingly painful hours for Hamilton to die by burning at the stake. Patrick Hamilton was Scotland's first Protestant martyr, just 24 years old at the time of his death. But the martyrdom of Patrick Hamilton inspired widespread interest in the Reformation and an intensified opposition to Catholicism. Hamilton's last words were, "How long, O Lord, shall darkness cover this realm? How long will you suffer the tyranny of men? Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." In 1543, the regent for the infant Mary, Queen of Scots, initiated a pro-English, therefore a Protestant policy, because this is during the reign of King Henry VIII. Although King Henry VIII was never a Protestant, he was at odds with the papacy, and his queens, at least the last five of them, were all Protestant, and his Chancellor was Protestant, and the Archbishop of Canterbury was secretly Protestant, Archbishop Thomas Cranmer. And so the regent in Scotland encouraged Bible reading and promoted preaching by reformers. And it was through the preaching of Thomas Gilliman, a converted friar, that John Knox was converted in 1543. And the exhilarating effect of this newfound faith and freedom and the joy of experiencing God's grace in Christ transformed Knox forever. Soon, however, the Scottish authorities reversed their initially pro-Reformation policies and began to threaten the Protestants. Tall, handsome, and well-mannered George Vysart became the spokesman for Scotland's growing Protestant movement. And Vysart travelled throughout the country proclaiming Reformation doctrines with skill and conviction. His archenemy was Cardinal David Beaton, the Archbishop of St. Andrews. He had five Protestants executed in 1544 and twice tried to have the popular Vysart murdered. After one failed attempt of his life, out of concern for his safety, the Protestants organized for Vysart to move his location daily to avoid capture. John Knox, depicted here in the background with a large double-handed sword, the broadsword, he is part of the bodyguard appointed to travel with Vysart, and those who came to service by George Vysart found that instead of the normal formal mass in Latin, there was congregational singing and a fiery hour-long sermon in their own tongue. In 1536, believing his arrest was imminent and unavoidable, Vysart dismissed his bodyguard, saying, "One is sufficient for a sacrifice." Vysart was condemned as a heretic, strangled and burned by order of Cardinal Beaton. And the reason why he was strangled was not mercy, it was to shut him up, because all too often these martyrs would be preaching and winning converts from the stake with the flames around them. And as the flame was lit, Vysart declared, "This flame hath scorched my body, yet it hath not daunted my spirit. But he who from yonder high place beholdest me with such pride shall within a few days lie in same as ignominiously as now he seemed proudly to rest himself." Within 2 months of the execution of Vysart, 16 Scottish nobles assassinated the Cardinal Andrew Beaton in the most brutal way. And before being struck down, beaten, was admonished, repent thee of thy former wicked life, but especially of the shedding of the blood of that notable instrument of God, Master George Weishaupt, which cries for vengeance. We from God are sent to revenge it. Thou hast been and remain an obstinate enemy against Jesus Christ and his holy evangel. Then a group of ardent Protestants, the Castilians, took over the city of St. Andrews and garrisoned themselves in the castle there. And although Knox was not part of either the assassination or the conspiracy to seize the castle, he joined the people in the castle and ministered to them. Impressed by Knox's teaching, they asked him to become the castle's chaplain. Now, although Knox had studied law and theology at the University of St. Andrews, and he had been ordained, because there were so many priests in Scotland, the real excess, he ended up becoming a tutor. And he had not previously served as a parish priest, although he was trained and ordained to do so. Knox was overwhelmed. He was reduced to tears, and he declined the offer, not feeling worthy. Which doesn't fit with the picture we normally have of Knox being quite fiery, super confident, almost obnoxious, abrasive, and so on. But he did not rush at the opportunity to be a preacher or a reformer. Over the next few days, the congregation persisted in extending to him the call. Then, while attending a local church service for St. Andrews, and this is all that's left of that original church at the time, Knox heard Dean John Anand affirming Catholicism, saying the Catholic Church was the bride of Christ. Knox stood up in his pew and interrupted this priest during the service, saying, "The Roman Catholic Church is no bride of Christ, it's a prostitute, harlot. The Roman papacy had degenerated further from the faith of the apostles than the Jews had from Moses when they crucified Christ. And just as the Jews could no longer claim to be the people of God, neither could the Church of Rome claim to be the people of God, since they have drifted far from the faith of the apostles." At this, the congregation loudly demanded that Knox justify his remarks in a sermon the next Sunday, which he did. And Knox declared the Roman Church has become the synagogue of Satan. He pulled no punches, and one observer noted, while others snipped at the outer branches of the papacy, Knox struck at the root to destroy the whole. And this was the beginning of the public career of one of the most powerful preachers of the Reformation, probably the most radical reformer of all. The French fleet laid siege to St. Andrew's Castle, which surrendered in July 1547, and the rebels were taken to Rouen in France. Knox and most of the Protestants were sentenced to a life sentence of being galley slaves. Now, you can basically imagine Ben-Hur pulling on a rose. It hadn't changed much from the first century. That's how ships were steamed. A life sentence in the galleys was the next most severe punishment after execution. Knox said very little about his time in the galleys, but two words he used to describe it were torment and affliction. During his time in the galleys, he contracted kidney infection and stomach ulcers, which afflicted him for the rest of his life. About 150 slaves or forces rowed in each galley, six to the oar. 25 oars were each about 45 feet long. The rowers are kept chained to the oar while not doing other duties. The committees on the ships carried whips to ensure that the prisoners of war, the convicts, pulled their weight, and that's where the term pulling your weight probably comes from. Galley slaves were considered a cheap and expendable form of fuel for ships.
Yeah.
That's how you ran ships, slaves. John Knox was about 33 years old when he was condemned to the galleys, and his strong character, which was evidenced throughout the rest of his life and his ministry, served him well throughout this ordeal. On one occasion, while the Mass was being celebrated on the galley and the Salve Regina, a holy queen, was being sung, a statue of the Virgin Mary, or the Nostra Dame, was being passed around for all on board to kiss. He refused, "Trouble me not, such an idol is accursed." When the statue was again thrust before Knox's face to kiss it, he grasped it and threw the idol overboard, saying, "Now let a lady save herself. She's light enough, let her learn to swim." You can imagine the punishment for that kind of obstinacy. Knox admitted that the prisoners on the galleys were miserably treated. They were placed under pressure to renounce their Protestant faith and to embrace Catholicism, which, of course, they refused to do. The English Protestant government now of the young King Edward VI took a direct interest in the plight of these prisoners, and in February 1549, after 18 months as a galley slave, Knox was released. This is probably at the direct intervention of King Edward VI, who took an interest in John Knox, and it was part of a prison exchange where the British had some French prisoners and exchanged them for these Scottish ones. Knox then spent the next 5 years in England as an honoured guest. He was granted preaching opportunities in Berwick and Newcastle. In 1551, Knox was appointed a royal chaplain to King Edward VI. And as a chaplain, he had the opportunity to preach before the king, and he contributed to the preparation of the Second Book of Common Prayer. In fact, it is Knox's exact wording that we have in the Book of Common Prayer to this day, that kneeling at the Lord's Supper does not imply any adoration of the bread and wine, nor is such adoration intended or permitted. On the contrary, it is stated explicitly, firstly, that the natural body and blood of Christ are in heaven, not on earth. Secondly, that at the Lord's Supper both the bread and the wine stay the same as the altar, adore them is idolatry. And that's his wording, and that's still in the Church of England's Book of Common Prayer. When Knox was invited to become a bishop of Rochester, he declined. In fact, it doesn't seem that John Knox liked any titles. He was basically hostile to a hierarchical church government, even though he was serving out of respect for King Edward in the Church of England at that time. When King Edward VI died on the 6th of July 1553, doubtless of poisoning, he had all the symptoms of poisoning, he was probably assassinated by a Jesuit priest. The future of the Protestants in England looked bleak because Mary Tudor, the elder sister, was the next in line according to order of succession. Now, King Edward VI had changed the order of succession for Lady Jane Grey, his Protestant cousin, who was the best qualified in his mind. And as king, he had the right to change the order of succession. But the bulk of the dukes in England and barons decided to take the side of Mary Tudor, and poor Lady Jane Grey was queen for only 9 days and was beheaded for refusing to renounce her faith. And her beloved cousin Mary Tudor had her cousin's head chopped off at age 15 for refusing to renounce her faith. And so Mary Tudor, known as Bloody Mary, she made clear her intention to reinstate Catholicism as the national religion. Knox described Mary as the wicked English Jezebel. Knox, along with thousands of other English Protestants, sought refuge in Protestant Germany and Switzerland, where, of course, they were influenced either by Lutheranism or by the Zwingliism, which later became Calvinism. Early in 1554, Knox travelled to Geneva, where he met John Calvin, and Knox described Calvin's Geneva as the most perfect school of Christ that ever was on earth since the days of the apostles. Knox also met Heinrich Bullinger while he was in Zurich, who is in many ways the elder statesman and the father of the Reformation in Switzerland, and to whom Calvin looked to with great respect as a senior. Knox settled in Frankfurt, where a group of English and Scottish exiles asked Knox to be their pastor. And this plunged Knox into distressing quarrels and controversies over what liturgy should be used. Knox was not an easy person to get on with, and he would not compromise on anything. And Knox had become critical now of the Book of Common Prayer, and even about Calvin's Genevan order of service. So he drew up a new order of service, which became known as the Book of Common Order. However, this was rejected by a large majority of his congregation, and by March 1555, the congregation was split, and the majority proposed Knox's dismissal. And that wasn't good enough to just dismiss their pastor. Some members of the congregation convinced the city authorities of Frankfurt to prohibit Knox from preaching and to expel him from the city, which they did. Now, it's interesting to note that although his Book of Common Order was rejected by the Scottish exiles in Frankfurt, in 1560, the Book of Common Order became the official worship book of the Church of Scotland. And it still is of the Free Church of Scotland. While Knox was in exile in Europe, Protestant congregations were forming back in Edinburgh, Dundee, St. Andrews, Perth, Brecon, and most of these were clandestine meetings, what you'd call underground meetings. Many used the English Book of Common Prayer as the alternative to the Catholic services. In December 1557, a group of Scottish nobles drew up a covenant to set forward and establish the most blessed word of God and his congregation to renounce Catholicism, to establish the Protestant faith as the official religion of Scotland, and they became known as the Lords of the Congregation. The bane of Mary, Queen of Scots' life. After being expelled from Frankfurt, Knox helped co-pastor an English congregation in Geneva. Now this was the chapel. In fact, even today it's used for English services in Geneva every Sunday. And there's a lot of different Reformed congregations use it. Local Presbyterians, including Koreans in Geneva, and English people, Scottish and others. But Calvin during the week used it for his academy, so he'd be training theological students there during the week, but on the weekend it could be used by the English-speaking refugees in Geneva. Then in August 1555, he returned to Scotland and spent 9 months preaching extensively throughout the land. And the Catholic bishop summoned him to Edinburgh in May 1556 to face legal charges. And Knox returned to Geneva, rather than answer the summons, where he assisted members of his congregation in the new translation of the Bible to English, which is known as the Geneva Bible. And he had a hand in that. And this great Bible of Geneva, 1560, is still considered the Bible of the Reformation. When people speak about the King James being the Bible of the Reformation, they don't fully understand it was the 17th century translation. The 16th century translation was the Geneva Bible. Knox asked Calvin whether it is permissible to resist by force a monarch who was idolatrous. John Calvin maintained that individuals might refuse to obey commands contrary to God's law, but he could not accept revolt. However, John Knox was coming to believe that Christians have the obligation to resist and revolt against tyrannical monarchs. A ruler's highest obligation is to preserve pure faith and worship. In Knox's A Godly Letter of 1554, he taught the nation could incur corporate guilt for tolerating evil. After all, you get corporate punishment. You will suffer droughts, famines, war, plagues as a result of national sin. Therefore, surely there's national guilt for the sins of national leaders. If the people permitted Catholicism to remain, the nation would be subjected to divine judgments and plagues. God punished the entire tribe of Benjamin, for example, not because everyone in Benjamin were adulterers, but because they tolerated some adulterers in Benjamin. In his 1549 leaflet, A Vindication of the Mass is Idolatry, Knox taught that idolatry entails not only worshipping what is not God, but entrusting anything other than God. To honor anything in religion contrary to God's word is to lean on something other than God, and that is idolatry. And the Mass is an abomination, he said. Because they lift up the host and they require people to bow and to genuflect and to literally adore the Mass, to adore the host, to bow before statues of Mary and to bow before crucifixes. And said the Mass promotes a false atonement based on works. You're not saved by that wafer. And since the law of God never changes, he must respond to sin in Scotland like he responded to sin in ancient Israel. For example, he raised up a Jehu, the military leader, to slay an idolatrous ruler. Knox demanded that God's law be upheld in Scotland. And if the people obeyed the unjust commandments of evil rulers, they would receive a far more terrible punishment from God than any ruler could inflict on them for treason. Not to revolt against an idolatrous ruler is plain rebellion against God. Because as we owe allegiance to our king, the king owes allegiance to the King of Kings. And if the king is rebelling to the King of Kings, you must not share in his rebellion. Knox maintained that when believers are in a minority, the faithful are only required to separate themselves from idolatry. However, when the believers are in a dominant position and reasonably unified, they must not simply separate from idolatry, they must abolish idolatry. If exterminating idolatry meant overthrowing a tyrannical ruler, then that was necessary. Knox's sermons and writings are full of the subject, with scriptural examples on Abraham, who mobilized his servants to overthrow five kings, and Elisha, and Hezekiah, and Jehu, and Elijah, and Amos, and Isaiah, Josiah, Jeremiah, many other passages which dealt with the covenants of God and purifying the national religion, resisting authorities who promoted idolatry, and continually exalting the sovereignty of God. If princes exceed their bounds, there's no doubt they may be resisted with power or with force. Now, just as Dr. Martin Luther was protected by Prince Frederick of Saxony, and Ulrich Zwingli was protected by the mayor and the council of Zurich, and John Calvin had the support of the Geneva City Council, the English Reformation at that time had King Edward VI providing political protection. However, there was no civil authority in Scotland that was able to provide protection for the Protestants. So Knox believed that the abuse of power should be overthrown. In this, Knox stands alone amongst the great leading reformers of the 16th century. He openly challenged the standard interpretation of Romans 13 held by such reformers as Luther, Zwingli, Tyndale, and Calvin. But as he pointed out, they had the privilege of civil authorities who provide them with protection. He did not. In his 1555 admonition to England, Knox condemned those rulers who had connived to restore the nation to Catholicism under Bloody Mary. Had she been sent to hell before these days, then should not their iniquity and cruelty so manifestly have appeared to the world. Now, to speak like that about a sovereign monarch must have been pretty bold. In 1558, Knox published his most notorious book, The First Blast of the Trumpet Against a Monstrous Regiment of Women, aimed primarily against Bloody Mary, the Queen of England at that time. But there were three Marys that he attacked. Because there was a Mary who was ruling in Scotland at that time. There was also a Mary Guise in France, who was a wicked witch as well. And there's a fourth Mary. There was also the Mary who was ruling Holland at that stage under the Spanish. So there were actually four hideous Catholic persecuted church, all called Mary at the same time. And so Knox stated no woman could be a legitimate ruler, and certainly not one who persecuted true Christians. Bloody Mary is a rebel against God and a traitress and a rebel against God. Knox declared it was against the law of God and of nature for such a woman to rule any kingdom. It subverted the divine and the natural order. He called for the faithful to remove from honor and authority that monster nation in nature. In his appellations to the nobility and commonalty of Scotland, he extended to the common people the right and the duty to rebel against tyranny. There is no other reformer who wrote or spoke like this. In fact, John Calvin severely disapproved of John Knox's first blast, and he banned its circulation in Geneva. So this is just going too far. Within weeks of its publication, Bloody Mary died after a bare 5 years on the throne and without any child, which is a major blessing, because otherwise Britain would have fallen under a whole Catholic line. Bearing in mind, Bloody Mary's husband was King Philip of Spain. And she herself was half Spanish, because her mother was Spanish. That meant any offspring she had would be three-quarters Spanish. And Britain would have been already under, effectively, the Spanish Empire. Some saw Knox's bold stand against the tyranny of Bloody Mary vindicated by her sudden removal and by the accession of the Protestant Queen Elizabeth to the throne of England. But most saw it as a monumental political mistake and distanced themselves from Knox. So Knox said, "My first blast has blown from me all my friends in England." Mm-hmm. Here you get a bit of understanding of how this works, of Henry the Seventh, who was the first Tudor king, had Henry the Eighth, but then also he had James the Fourth, who was king of Scotland, and then you also see how that's also brought out Margaret Tudor, out of whom came, you've got to follow all the way to Mary, Queen of Scots, and Bloody Mary or Mary Tudor. So people get confused between the Marys, just like there are quite a few Herods in the Bible. There's four Herods just in the Gospels and the Book of Acts, just to completely confuse things. And Mary Tudor was the sister of Edward VI and of Elizabeth I. Half-sisters, of course. I mean, Henry VIII, after all, did have six wives. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. Those are the six wives of Henry VIII. But as a result of the first of them, the Catherine of Aragon, the Spanish, was Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, who was the worst of the worst of the worst of the monarchs that England's had, with the only close second being John the worst. Nor did John Knox's public statement of support for new Queen Elizabeth I as a Protestant Queen of England repair the damage of his once strong links with the Church of England. Queen Elizabeth I was appalled at his tract, and Knox explained the monstrous regiment of women was referring to Bloody Mary Tudor of England, Mary Guise of France, and the Mary also in Holland, and Mary Queen of Scots. This didn't prepare the breach. This was seen as an anti-female tract, which wasn't actually his intention, but unfortunately he used very bad terminology, and his relations with the English was quite shattered by this. In May 1559, Knox arrived in Perth, and his fiery sermon against Catholic idolatry was so effective that when the service was over, the congregation immediately began to demolish altars, smash images, statues, and crucifixes. You can see here in St. Giles in Edinburgh, the people attending a service in their battle armour, with their broadswords, with their banners, with their picts and spears. Evidently, they weren't expecting a normal sermon, and he wasn't satisfied with people saying afterwards, "I enjoyed that message, that was nice." His messages were calls to action, and the actions here were annihilate Catholicism and all of its superstitious trappings. Smash idols, statues, crucifixes, demolish altars, everything that symbolized Catholicism, remove it. And the lords of the congregation then militarily occupied Perth, Stirling, St. Andrews, and Edinburgh. And there, Knox was elected minister at St. Giles Kirk in High Street, and his Reformation preaching reverberated throughout all of Scotland. To counter Mary of Guise and her French troops, the Scottish lords of the congregation drew up the Treaty of Berwick, February 1560, with the English. And this treaty was so effective that on the 6th of July, 1560, all the French and all the English troops left Scottish soil. And this helped preserve the Reformation in Scotland, because without French interference, without the French troops, the future of Scotland was assured, because the Catholics didn't have enough military power in Scotland without the French troops. Later that month, the Scottish Parliament met at St. Giles, Edinburgh, for a great Thanksgiving service where John Knox preached to them. And the Parliament then ordered Knox and five of his colleagues to write a confession of faith. They hurriedly put this to paper in 4 days, and the Scots confession was vibrant, spontaneous, filled with prophetic, militant language. It was adopted by Parliament and remained for 90 years the Scottish Church's official theology. It was only replaced in 1647 by the Westminster Confession, which contains a lot of its same sentiments. The Scots Confession stands out in how it specifies practical Christian ethics. It urges good citizenship, honourable living, a commitment to social justice, with words like these: to have one God, to worship and honour him, to call on him in all our troubles, to reverence his holy name, to hear his word and to believe it, to share in his holy sacraments. The second kind is to honour father, mother, monarchs, rulers, superior powers, to love them, support them, obey their orders, providing they are not contrary to God's commandments, save the lives of the innocent, overthrow tyranny, defend the oppressed, keep our bodies clean and holy, live in soberness and temperance, deal justly with all men in word and deed, and finally to subdue any desire to harm our neighbour. Contrary acts are sin. Notice the description of who God is in the first chapter. We acknowledge and confess one God alone, to whom alone we must cleave, whom alone we must serve, whom alone we must worship, in whom alone we put our trust, who is eternal, infinite, immeasurable, incomprehensible, omnipotent, invisible, one in substance, yet distinct in three persons, Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, by whom we confess and believe all things in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, to have been created. The Scots Confession not only permits the overthrowing of tyrants, but makes such action mandatory, obligatory. Tyrants are defined as the real rebels to the King of Kings. Article 13 defines workers of iniquity as filthy persons, idolaters, drunkards, thieves, murderers, oppressors, and cruel persecutors, which describes a lot of governments in the world right now. The Scots Confession makes it clear that no civil power is absolute. All authority by God is delegated power, unlimited and conditional. Civil leaders are permanently on probation. No Christian should give unqualified absolute allegiance to any government. Christians must preserve the right of just rebellion against tyrants. This sort of explains why John Knox is not everyone's favourite reformer. No other Reformation confession ventured so far into such dangerous waters and provided theological justification for rebellion against tyrants. As Knox declared, dangerous times demand vigorous faith. On August the 17th, Parliament abolished the Mass, repudiated papal jurisdiction over Scotland, rescinded all laws at variance with the Reformed faith. Now, if any of this sounds extreme, just bear in mind what it's following. It's following all the persecutions of Bloody Mary and burning the Archbishop of Canterbury and bishops and Bible translators and church squares in England, and all the harsh persecutions of Christians in Holland and the massacres of the Huguenots in France. So there was good reason why the people in Scotland were reacting like this. It was after the persecution of Wishart and Hamilton, and so the people of Scotland were not just dealing with some hypothetical doctrinal issue. They were dealing with real persecution of a real physical military threat from Catholicism. Also in 1560, a very busy year, Knox's Treatise on Predestination was published in Geneva, and the Geneva Bible was published, so the princes in Geneva were busy. And this was the work of the English congregation that Knox had pastored for a time. In December 1560, the first book of discipline was drawn up by Knox and his colleagues and submitted to the General Assembly. And Knox laid out plans for the comprehensive application of the gospel to every area of Scottish life. He wanted a school in every parish. Every church has to have a school. A college in every town. A university in every city. Regular organized provision for the poor. Also in 1560, Knox's wife Marjorie died. Although the Reformation Parliament of 1560 had worked with John Knox to mandate Calvinist Scotland, the return of the Catholic Mary, Queen of Scots, in 1561 put all that in jeopardy. She had reached the age where she could ascend to the throne, and so she's it's legally a monarchy, and here the monarch returns, and she's Catholic, although the whole country now is pretty solidly Protestant. As Queen, she refused to ascend to the new order, and Scotland remained officially Catholic, but not in practice. Mary Stuart was heir to England's throne if Elizabeth died. She was next in line to succession in Britain legally. And with her strong ties to Philip II in Spain and to the Guises of France, she is a widow of a French prince, the Catholic threat to Scotland's emerging Reformation was very serious. The Scots were well aware that in the Netherlands, Protestants were being tortured, beheaded, hung, drowned, burned, buried alive by the Vatican's heavy hand. They had recently witnessed the wave of horrible executions under Bloody Mary in neighbouring England. And so this was a very clear and present danger. Catholicism, personified in Mary, Queen of Scots, is threatening their lives and their faith. As rumours circulate that Mary Stuart would marry Don Carlos, the son of Philip II of Spain, and the arch persecutor of the Protestants, Knox preached a withering sermon declaring all papists are infidels. Philip II was well aware that Mary Stuart was the Vatican's best hope of restoring Catholicism to England. He said, "She is the one gate through which religion can be restored in England. All the rest are closed." Mary Stuart then married Lord Darnley of England, bringing hope to unite the Catholics of England with the Catholics of Scotland. Getting fewer in number, mind you. When the Queen became pregnant, her young husband accused the Queen of adultery with her private secretary, David Rizzo. Lord Darnley, now King Henry, participated in the murder of Rizzo, 9th of March, 1556. And on 15th of June, 1556, Mary Stuart delivered a son, James Charles Stuart, who grew up to be James I of England. His son was Charles I of England, who was beheaded. But this is the famous James I who became the King James of the King James Bible, the first king of the United Kingdom of Scotland and England. In revenge for voicing his suspicions, Mary Stuart arranged the assassination of her husband, King Henry, or Lord Darnley, through her boyfriend, the Earl of Bothwell. Mary coaxed Henry back to Edinburgh, lulled his suspicions, and arranged for him to be blown up with explosives. She is the archetype Black Widow. Both Protestants and Catholics in Scotland were outraged. Mary had Bothwell stand a mock trial at which he is acquitted, and then she gave him Dunbar Castle and various lands to his associates in his crime. Knox was called before the Queen's Council, where he voiced the suspicions. He then confronted Bothwell with charges of adultery, complicity in murder, and rape. When Queen Mary married Bothwell, May 1567, the nation was convinced that she had helped murder her husband. There's widespread calls for her to be deposed, and the people turned against her. Knox demanded that the Queen stand trial for murder and adultery, both capital crimes at that time. And Mary Stuart was forced to abdicate, and the nobles organized the swift coronation of her infant, James VI of Scotland, who later became James I of England and of the United Kingdom, and the one who, in whose name the King James Bible of 1611 has been published. Now, at this coronation of this young infant King James, Knox preached from the pulpit about the baby Joash, who was anointed and crowned while Queen Attila cried treason from her palace. And then the sermon included the details in the Bible as to how the nobles went straight from the coronation of Joash to kill Attila, to tear down the temples of Baal, and to restore the rule of the prophets in the land. And you can imagine how he applied these principles to present-day Scotland. While Knox was calling for the trial of Mary Stuart, she escaped and raised an army of 6,000 Catholics. However, when they faced the disciplined Protestants, Mary's army melted before the battle could even begin. She fled to England. She sought the protection of a cousin, who she had tried to murder many a time, Queen Elizabeth. Bothwell fled to Denmark. James Stuart, Mary's half-brother, became regent of Scotland. And James Stuart had been an influential figure in Scottish politics. By age 19, he was already a member of the Privy Council, which would be today the Cabinet. He became Mary, Queen of Scots' chief advisor when she returned to Scotland. However, as he was won over to the Protestant faith and became a member of the Lords of the Congregation, he used his power to extend the influence of Protestantism and to maintain the Protestant rights. When Mary was forced to abdicate in 1567 and her infant son, James VI, was crowned, Stuart was appointed regent, effectively made him chancellor, prime minister. He was described as a Puritan with a natural charm and diplomacy. At the same time, Europe was boiling. The Spanish Duke of Alva had fallen upon the Calvinist rebels of Holland with fire and sword. 8,000 Dutch Protestants were executed. Another 30,000 had their property confiscated. Then in 1568, the Inquisition condemned all 3 million Dutch Protestants to death as heretics. The Dutch valiantly resisted and declared independence. And all of this is going on at the same time as the battles in Scotland. This is just across the channel in Holland. Along with the war in the Netherlands and civil war in France, a papal bull excommunicating Elizabeth inspired a Catholic uprising under the Earls of Northumberland and Westmoreland. And the Catholic armies of Northumberland destroyed Bibles and prayer books and reinstituted the Mass in Durham Cathedral, the northernmost cathedral in England, and moved to rescue Mary Stuart to make her Queen of England. Elizabeth's army crushed the Catholic rebellion, and after numerous other intrigues and conspiracies to assassinate her, she had to be placed on trial. The efforts of the Catholic conspirators to put Mary, Queen of Scots, on the throne of England was exposed, and so Elizabeth finally reluctantly agreed to her trial. Mary was found guilty and executed despite Elizabeth's every attempt to try and save her life. Parliament knew they were just a heartbeat away from a Catholic queen, and if any of the 67 odd attempts to assassinate Elizabeth had succeeded, then they would have been under Catholic rule. So they had to get rid of Mary Stuart. Mary Stuart was definitely a conspirator anyway to try and murder her own cousin. The assassination in February 1570 of the Protestant regent of Scotland, James Stuart, plunged Scotland into civil war, another Jesuit-led assassination. Later that year, Knox suffered a stroke, but he continued to preach throughout the last months of his life, and even as his health was deteriorating, he insisted on being carried to the pulpit. Before he died in 1572, Knox had the joy of seeing the Scottish reforms of 1560 ratified by the Scottish Parliament. Papal authority in Scotland was outlawed. All future rulers of Scotland were to swear to uphold the Reformation doctrine. The day before he died, Knox said, "I have been fighting against Satan, who is ever ready for the assault. I have fought against spiritual wickedness, and I have prevailed." The dedicated labours of John Knox resulted in Scotland becoming the most Calvinist nation in the world. Otter Scott in the Great Christian Revolution summarises his achievements. Knox had humbled a reigning monarch, toppled the government, ousted the hierarchy, converted the people, and could regard towards the end of his life the landscape transformed by his efforts and the teaching of his mentor, Calvin. Knox's triumph in Scotland severed a tentacle of France. Scotland had always been controlled by France before that, and lessened the threat of the Reformation of England. At his grave, one man declared, "Here lies a man who neither flattered nor feared any flesh." One of Knox's followers declared, "His preaching was able in 1 hour to put more life into us than 500 trumpets, continually blustering in our ears." John Knox once said, "I've never once feared the devil, but I tremble every time I enter the pulpit." And that's the point. He feared God. The 19th century historian Thomas Carlyle described Knox as a most surprising individual to have kindled all of Scotland within a few years, almost within a few months, into perhaps the noblest flame of sacred human zeal and brave determination to believe only what it found completely believable and to defy the whole world and the devil at its back in an unsubduable defense of the same. John Knox was the very epitome of stalwart leadership. The most Scottish of Scots, nothing hypocritical, nothing foolish, nothing untrue can find harbour in this man, fearing God and without any other fear. Douglas Wilson, in his biography of Knox for Kirk and Covenant, describes him as like Daniel of the Old Testament. He was forthright in his condemnation of sin, unguarded in his pronouncement of truth, single-minded in his adherence to the Word of God, like King Josiah in ancient Israel. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, never turning aside to the right hand or to the left. Like the great general Joshua, he dutifully obeyed the clear commands of Scripture, always steadfast and unwavering. But such character traits and such stands, however compelling, are inevitably costly. It nearly cost Knox everything during his lifetime, and it has earned him the odium and ire of virtually every secular historian in the years since. A simple compromise here or there might well have saved him from imprisonment, exile, and anathema. But he refused to compromise. He could have tried to work within the system. He could have tried conciliation or accommodation or negotiation. But he refused to compromise, risking everything for the sake of principle. John Knox was described by John Calvin as God's firebrand, and a brother labouring energetically for the faith. Mary, Queen of Scots, had been heard to declare, trembling and in tears, "I am more afraid of the prayers of John Knox than of an army of 10,000. Now, I might just make a comment about how Hollywood twists things. Hollywood produced this disgusting film on Mary, Queen of Scots, with Vanessa Redgrave playing probably her most famous role. Vanessa Redgrave's a genuine communist. She is like what Jane Fonda is to America, so Vanessa Redgrave is to Britain. And in this film, it's got John Knox declaring, as Mary Queen of Scots, are saying, "I'm more afraid of the mass than of an army of 10,000. There is no way that John Knox said anything like that. He didn't believe in being afraid of anything at all. They took the quote of Mary Queen of Scots and deliberately turned it around. So Mary Queen of Scots came over as the noblest of person, John Knox the horrible person in this Hollywood film. It's just a classic example of how they can twist things. But this is the fact. Mary Queen of Scots said, "I am more afraid of the prayers of John Knox than of an army of 10,000. They can be pretty sure he was not praying the prayer of Jabez. John Knox's famous prayer, "Give me Scotland or I die," was thoroughly answered in his lifetime. He saw his country go from 4% church attendance when he began his ministry to 94% church attendance by his death. Phenomenal transformation of the country. I fought the good fight. I've finished the race. I've kept the faith. I think that verse applies to John Knox more than to many others. And John Knox is honored in Geneva, the fountainhead of the Scottish Reformation. This is the original chapel where Calvin began his academy before he had an actual building dedicated to it, and this became the main building for the English exiles and Scottish exiles. If you go to the Great Reformation Monument in Geneva, post tenebris lux, after darkness light, you'll notice there are the pillars on each side say Luther and Zwingli, the German reformers who laid the foundations of the Reformation. But this wall is primarily dedicated to the Presbyterian section of the Reformation. So while they recognize Luther and Calvin as being pillars, the central figures here are the members of the French Reformation. Three of these four are French. Of course, John Calvin and Farel and Beza are French, but John Knox stands out as the one who is the exception. He is not the John Knox on the far right. He's the one non-French speaker of the four there. But notice in the foreground, in front of the main statues, you've got three city crests, or three crests. Obviously, the central one would be of Geneva. It's got the eagle representing coming out of the empire of the Austro-Hungarians, and the key of the city. And then it's got the bear of Bern. Bern was the city-state in Switzerland that first became Protestant, and it shipped out and funded Pierre Verret and Fomont and Farel, who won Geneva to Christ. But notice there's the Lion of Scotland, the Scottish emblem. That's the only other emblem aside from two Swiss emblems. You've got Scotland's. Why? Because Scotland was the first country to fully apply the principles of John Calvin. And this gives you a bit of perspective of the size of this monument. Huge. Very impressive. And you notice John Calvin's appears slightly taller, representing his prominence. He's got both hands on his Bible. Farel's the only one who's holding his Bible in his left hand, because his right hand's on a fist, ready for a fight. Beza has got the book highest. He's the theologian. He's the one who ran the academy after Calvin's death. And John Knox, well, he's the one on the left-hand side. I suppose he's the revolutionary. So you've got the two academic theologians in the middle and the two firefighting revolutionaries on the side. Also, you can get a better picture on this serious fist there. That they were thinking about this very clearly, where William Farel is marked with the fist, and his Bible's got a finger, his left holding it in the left hand, his finger sort of holding the place in the Bible where he's going to preach from, after he's thumped the bishop and taken possession of his pulpit, probably. In the Reformation wall, you have prayers and scriptures in German, in French, in English. And here's a portion from the Geneva Bible, the Lord's Prayer. And notice it's got John Knox preaching the Reformation at St. Giles. And so here's an etching in a wall that specifically identifies who the individuals are written there to. The five solas of the Reformation. They started in Wittenberg, they went to Geneva, made the impact in Zurich and in Scotland. So, these are some of the background pictures as well. That's St. Giles. St. Giles, also, bear in mind, is where, I should say St. Andrews, is where the heir to the British throne tends to study. And you'll notice that William met Catherine at St. Andrews, which is one of the key universities now. So, any questions, any comments?
never a Bible translated into Scottish language?
That's a good question. I'm not aware of any. That's interesting, as the Scottish and the Welsh had their own language, but they tend to be using the English Bibles in their churches, aren't they?
Irish should also be a question.
The Irish certainly have their Bibles, but in the Free Church of Ireland, they certainly are using the English Bible, King James specifically. But the Geneva Bible was very, very popular for 130 years. It took a long time, something like 70 years after the King James Version came out, before the King James started to supplant the Geneva Bible as the premier Bible of use in the churches. So many people seem to think there was no Bible then, there was the King James, and only recently you've had modern translations. For a long time, they looked at the King James as the modern translation, and the stalwart should say, we want the Geneva Bible.
What did the King James change from the Geneva Bible?
The most important changes was there were no footnotes. The Geneva Bible's got lots of Reformation-type footnotes, comments on the margins, which specifically identified the papacy as Antichrist and things like that, which of course, the Romanists would have had a fit over. And so it had a lot of the solas and the Reformation statements and doctrines in the footnotes. And so the first order that King James gave was, he wanted a Bible without footnotes. And the other one was, instead of speaking about pastors, he wanted the words bishops back in. And the other requirement from King James was no mention of homosexuals, because, of course, the Bible speaks about homosexuals, no homosexual in the kingdom of heaven and so on. And so they expressly forbade that terminology. Now, the wise people who put together the King James Bible, they still got the same message over. If a man lies with a man as man lies with a woman, then he is an abomination. They couldn't use the one word that was there in the Greek. They had to use a whole lot of extras because they'd been expressly ordered by King James not to use the word homosexual, even though it appeared in the Bible multiple times. Definitely. Yeah, we've got here by Oscar Scott, who did the Great Christian Revolution. He says a few things about that in that book, but we've got he's got a book on the fool, and he speaks, which is actually on James. He despised him. In fact, most of the Reformed people, and the Puritans in particular, loathed King James, which is just one reason why they wouldn't like the translation. Now, not to say the King James 1611 is an excellent translation, of course it is. It just is that it's a pity it ever had the name of this reprobate attached to it, because there's next to no evidence that the man was regenerate at all. He wasn't a good man at all. He persecuted church. And look at the fruit. James the First's son was Charles the First, who was justly tried and beheaded for treason. And his grandson was Charles the Second, who was even worse. And James the Second was so apostate that sparked the glorious revolution of 1688, when the English asked the Huguenot king to come over from Holland and be their king. And that's when William the Third and Mary took the throne of England, and they kicked out James the Second because he was just so apostate. So there wasn't one good Stuart. All the Stuart kings were just apostate, apostate, apostate. From James the First, Charles the Second, Charles the First, Charles the Second, James the Second, all four of them, basic rituals. Absolutely reprobate. Shocking, shocking, disgraceful, hideous. Although, having said that, one of the granddaughters was the Mary who married William, and that was the link to get William in. Who's the victor of the Battle of the Bourne and the Glorious Revolution. They called it the Glorious Revolution because next to no blood was shed, because nobody wanted to fight for James II. They all defected, and God save the king, except the new king and queen, and James II was running off to France. So it is bizarre that we've got a Bible which is mostly the work of William Tyndale. It's been proven that James, the King James Bible, is 90% William Tyndale's work in the New Testament. And what, if anything, you should just call it the Holy Bible, but if you've got to name it after a person, name it after William Tyndale. Mm. Mm. James the First had nothing to do with it. Mm.
So did the Geneva Bible take William Tyndale's Bible and then they added a few footnotes?
Pretty much. It had to have been. They would have refined and improved it because the English language would have developed and evolved too. But the Geneva Bible, what makes the Geneva Bible so unique, was not just very accurate solid, but the fact that they had all these footnotes that drove the papists insane. We've got a couple of Geneva Bibles here. And Philip Stott really likes his. Now, it is fading, because when the Pope visited England, was it last year, or was it the year before last? The Pope visited England fairly recently, and he was received in Holyrood Castle in Edinburgh, specifically because that was where John Knox had confronted Mary, Queen of Scots, and the Pope chose to be received by the Queen in Holyrood Castle. Very symbolic. And then he also had a major reception, speech or something, in one of the Westminster halls attached to Parliament, which is exactly where the Westminster Confession was produced, which declared the Pope Antichrist. So, very symbolic place for his meeting in Scotland and in London. Chose the two places strongest associated with the renouncement of Catholicism to have his recent meeting. And the English government was so dull or apostate that they acceded to this. But from the Catholic point of view, it must have been a very symbolic victory.
Do you think the Jesuits, the unseen people, arranged the...
I wouldn't doubt it. The Jesuits are some of the cleverest people in Catholicism. And to have a Jesuit Pope right now is very disconcerting, because the Jesuits were specifically brought about as the shock troops of the Counter-Reformation to destroy the Reformation. So they have been responsible for thousands of assassinations through the centuries, including people as prominent as the Prince Regent of Scotland in 1572 and assassination of the King of England, King Edward VI. I mean, those are pretty clear. But there have been many other assassinations. The Jesuits are absolutely devious, and I can't imagine they do anything by accident. And this present Pope is a charm offensive. He's very cleverly coming to give a new impression of Catholicism and to charm the Protestants and the Pentecostals, and he's doing all the right moves.
Where does the rumour lie as to what William's affiliations are?
Well, he has to be Protestant. He's got to be a Church of England member, or he wouldn't have a chance of having the throne. So, I would guess that he's outwardly, nominally so, and recognizes it's part of his duty, but I don't know if there's anything resembling a born-again experience yet. He did go for a church wedding, formal church wedding, but maybe that was pushed on him. I don't know if that was his personal choice. They seem to be doing, but the royals play a role. It's hard to know how much comes from their heart and how much is just duty. Very hard to tell. And unfortunately, you know, much as I'm sympathetic to the Queen, she has presided over a disastrous time in British history, a debacle, really. And her father as well, but we know that they don't make the policy as much. You can blame people like the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, more for a lot of the chaos. But the Queen still signed legislation such as legalization of abortion. She could have, like the King of Belgium, said, no, I refuse. You cannot expect me to. She could have gone further. This would break my coronation oath, to rule in accordance with the Gospels of Christ and the laws of God. The coronation oath is very specific. So, for the Queen to, in fact, the Queen is presented with a Bible by the Archbishop of Canterbury. and commanded to rule in accordance with this, and then she must, as part of coronation oath, swear to rule in accordance with the scriptures, in accordance with the laws of God and the gospel of Christ as contained in the Holy Scriptures. It's such a clear pledge. Like when Martin Luther said, you didn't force me to take this oath to defend and proclaim the truth of the gospel as contained in the Holy Scriptures when they made him a doctor of theology in the university. He said, you made me take this oath, and now I'm compelled to be true to this oath. And so I think the Queen could have just, you know, fire me. I will not sign. But I don't think that anyone could have forced it. It could create a constitutional crisis, but so what? Let it. So I think the royal family in Britain has failed, and I think the Queen's been ill-advised, and I think that the throne's been hijacked in a sense that they've even made the throne in Britain subservient to Brussels in a sense. That here the Queen made a speech early this year to expel the foreign citizens who are guilty of crime from the country. And then she's informed later on you can't do that if they're members, if they're citizens of the EU, nobody in the EU can expel someone from their country if they're part of the EU. So if you've got, say, a French criminal, a Muslim who's got technical French citizenship, committing crime in England, he can't be expelled. It's just bizarre. So that's just another good reason to get out of the EU. But what they've done is made the Queen no longer sovereign, but subservient to rules that come from Brussels, which is outrageous. I mean, Brussels is a bunch of secular humanist New World Order characters sympathetic with socialism. Put it nicely. So, any comments? So this year, 500th anniversary of John Knox, definitely not everyone's favourite reformer, but he's certainly the most radical, and some have said certainly the most consistent reformer. No one went so far as John Knox. And you think of the vast amount of missionaries that have come out of Scotland, how God has blessed the world with missionaries like Mary Slessor and David Livingstone. Scotland's produced phenomenal soldiers, phenomenal missionaries, great reformers, made a great impact in the world. And to a large extent, you can say that's thanks to the excellent foundations laid by John Knox. But he is despised in his own country today. They've put a parking lot over his grave. So now, literally, there's just a marker in a parking lot in Edinburgh as to where the grave of John Knox is. And that's what the people of Scotland think about their most famous and greatest son, I would say. It's just, you know, you can't imagine anyone doing anything like that anywhere else in the world to someone important in the estimation we've got. You can go and there is a tremendous amount of respect for Baron von Richthofen and his grave, and for the grave of Zwingli or Luther. You could say Calvin, but you can't, because John Calvin, by order, was buried anonymously in an unmarked grave. Some people think that's tracked down, but I mean, he specifically didn't want anyone visiting it, so it was ordered, made bears a promise that they'd make sure that no one would know where his grave is. It's a secret burial at night, so nobody can trek there, because John Calvin was so... in fact, I made the comment when we had the Calvin 500 in Geneva, that what would John Calvin say if he was here? None. What are you doing? He would not have approved of such an event at all. But, you know, we went there to honour him as much as the Lord who used them. So, who'd like to close in prayer? Colin, thank you.
Father God, I thank you for this time that Peter had learning about John Knox and what he meant to the Reformation and the work he did for you, Father. I do pray that each one of us will be ignited some of this zeal that he had, Father, to change the world, to advance your kingdom, Father. And I just thank you for being able to give these lectures and show up the truth. So thank you for listening.